Hello and welcome to another edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a tight firm of small faces prepped for the heist of the century, or at least ready to sing like canaries on everything from the cultural impact of Scottish whisky to the top uses of salvaged coal from the Titanic, the problem with Winterval in Ireland, and the best way for artists to tool up for the coming eco-apocalypse. And first this time, the irresistible attractions of letterpress. Okay, not everybody is susceptible, but our guest this time, letterpress printer and fine press bookmaker Jamie Murphy, has got it bad. Like, make your own ink out of salvaged Titanic coal bad. Culture File's Louis Scully went to visit Murphy amidst the presses at his NCAD base in Dublin.
So I'm Jamie Murphy, and I'm a letterpress printer and a graphic designer. I work in NCAD as the letterpress technician, and I produce books under the imprint of the Salvage Press. I grew up wanting to be an artist, not really knowing what that entailed, just wanting to draw pictures and make things by hand. At 17, I came to college in NCAD on Thomas Street and developed an interest in illustration and typography and letterpress printing. And that was my introduction to letterpress printing, and it's a passion that I haven't really let go of since. More recent years, it's become all-consuming, and I think it's where my entire artistic interests lie. Letterpress printing is very much a technology and a process. It involves pieces of metal type. Each individual piece is one letter, and so these pieces of type would be cast from type metal, which is lead, antimony, and tin. It's an alloy. Each individual letter would be composed one after the next to form words and lines and paragraphs and pages. And from there, that work is taken to a printing press. The printing press involves a bed where the type is laid down. It involves rubber and steel rollers. The ink is applied by hand, and the rubber will touch off the metal type, because you would never have metal touch metal. All of these rollers working together would form a consistency in the spread of the ink, and then one by one these prints are rolled out by hand along a cylinder. Letterpress is essentially what it says. It takes letters, it presses them into paper, and so you can control the amount of impression. I tend to make very little bite, but what happens with a lot of commercial letterpress is that a lot of client-driven work opt for more bite, a heavier bite, because it gives such a tactile quality to a piece. And so if you ever find letterpress invitations or, you know, ephemera that has a heavy bite, you'll find that it's quite different to finely printed books, which have quite a low bite, what people often refer to as a kiss. My first printing experience was crude liner prints in school, carved with those yellow and red handled liner cut tools that were blunt because they were handed out to us from like the kitty in school. And they were crude, but I enjoyed the process. I enjoyed the idea. You could create an image in your mind and produce it on paper, then transfer it to a lino, cut it in reverse, print it in a positive. And the idea that you could make multiples of it was quite interesting, because you could experiment with color and with texture as you move forward. Letterpress printing to me has always been a tool on a journey to making a book. Letterpress printing to other people means different things, and so some people use it as a full-time trade, which would be known as a jobbing printer, where other people would supply designs and then they would produce these designs either from metal composed by hand or either from polymer plates or magnesium plates, but it's very much specifically client orientated. If you're into it in a hobby sense, you're getting personal fulfillment from it. I guess the area that I work in is more focused on almost exclusively on typography and books, and very much for myself along my own sort of path. And because these books are so time consuming, they're very much a labor of love. My investigation into the letterpress printers on board the Titanic, that was really the springboard to what I do now, and it being such an involved and focused project gave me more insight into what goes into making, I guess, a well-conceived, well-thought-out, well-produced, well-manufactured letterpress book. It was a 2-year undertaking, 176 pages. It was an all-encompassing project, and one of the first all-encompassing projects that I had truly had enough time to do, where every single element was considered and nothing was left to chance, which in a way is fine press bookmaking. One of the elements of that book was the ink that I made, which was produced from coal taken from the wreck site 2-3 miles beneath the Atlantic on the seabed, the final resting place of the Titanic. And it's one of the last and only pieces from that wreckage that some particular salvage crew are able to actually openly trade. And so I was able to acquire like a thumbnail size piece of coal for 50 or 60 quid and grind it down and make it into a really, really fine powder and mix that with transparent base. So it gave it a pigment, gave it a colour and a hue, which is actually quite sepia in tone. And so it was quite, I guess, true to the photographic methods of the time. And so, yeah, a little bit of the Titanic ended up in each of these books. But I've actually never screen printed, in the same way that I've never skied. I feel like I've got an addictive, compulsive personality. And if I ever ski, it'll cost me a fortune. And if I ever screen print, it'll cost me a fortune. So I just cut them out of my life.
Jamie Murphy there talking to Louis Scully, and you can find all of Jamie's productions at thesalvagepress.com. Now, I don't know if anyone mentioned it, but many Earthlings are worried about the way things are going on their home planet, what with the fires and the floods and the tiny plastic beads, and some of them are busy trying to get a message out. But do they have the right methods, the right tools? For Carlow-based ecological artist and former scientist Cathy Fitzgerald, we need a huge shift in creative practices, a shift that brings art and ecology together to imagine new ways of living for the Earth and its inhabitants. As a step in that direction, Fitzgerald recently held the first in a series of eco-literacy workshops aimed at supporting artists to develop an ecological worldview and transform their practice. Culture Files' Rachel Andrews attended.
Oh. Oh, it's not good. But you know that. Tell me you do. Tell me that the messages are getting through.
I've been looking at this area since the late 90s, and it's always struck me that how the ecological catastrophes being presented in the media is through scientists, and we've got to be very thankful that they have been alerting us for decades. We've got politicians sort of starting to talk about it. But there are key people not at the table, and creative people, the poets, particularly the philosophers about wisdom, beauty and truth about the times we're living in, psychologies, all that social support. And I'd really love to see the Irish arts community take this on like they've done with some of the other social issues in recent years. But I just feel that some of the institutions are going to be moving slowly to change their curricula. And I think they might think, well, yes, let's do art with a nature theme. But no, it's a paradigm shift. And I think we need all these different supports for creative people. I was one of those children that loved a lot of different things as a child. I got into science. I wasn't supported at my family at that time to go to art college. When I came to Ireland, I came in the mid-90s. Not a lot of jobs in science. And I volunteered with CRAN, the tree organisation. So my tribe here are foresters and people looking at permanent forestry, continuous cover forestry, and then I got into art college. And I brought these different aspects of myself together. It wasn't until I found the pioneering ecological artists who work collaboratively with scientists, local politicians, people who've got wisdom in their communities or know their land, and I thought that's a model I can really hope to emulate.
So, I'm going to go over just a history of ecological understanding, and then at the end of the session just sort of reinforce how the arts can help. And I wanted to put a warning, because as all of you have touched on this, once you start thinking about it, it's just there with us.
There was one movie, or a very short film you showed, called Solastasia. Maybe you could tell me what that means.
Yeah. There was another philosopher, Professor Glenn Elbert. He's a retired farmer, philosopher. He'd worked a long time in sustainability areas, and because he's in Australia, he had people coming to him who were devastated living next door to open cast mines. They may have had jobs in the area. They couldn't move. Their properties were devalued. They were having emotional, mental distress. He's just felt that he needed a language to describe this broken feeling of feeling not at home where your home is. So that's solastalgia. He came up with that term over 10 years ago. It's used by eco-psychologists around the world. It's also used in some legal situations in Australia. I didn't realise when I came across an article of his a few years ago that he was working on an entire book of new terms. And many people have heard of the term the Anthropocene, this age of man, this car wreck that of a culture and the devastation it's caused. So he came up with words to think about this way of living together and recognising the interconnection between all living beings, and he called it the symbiosing.
I think lunch is almost here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought we'd end with this one. It's a reflection by Katie Goodman.
I didn't want to have this day as just being a heavy day, so I tried to bring in quite a bit of humour as well. So,
I suppose you need that, really, because there is, it feels very oppressive and very dark.
Quite a number of people had listened to the podcast Mothers of Invention with Mary Robinson and a comedian. Who would have thought that Mary Robinson, with her really deep knowledge of human suffering, feminist issues, you know, she would have seen young women affected all over the world, and teaming her up with Maeve. You feel like you're around the dinner table with a group of people who are really caring, and sometimes they just need to laugh. That idea of the hopometer, which I borrowed from a professor of environmental moral philosophy, Kathleen Dean Moore in America, I take a temperature reading at the beginning of the day using that and at the end. And it is true, after we've come together and talked and shared, we do feel a little bit more sort of empowered.
And I think it was Kathleen as well talks about moving from the me to the we.
She does, yeah. She definitely says one of the big problems when she gets asked by students, what can I do? She said, stop being I, become we. A lot of our art colleges are talking about developing yourself, self-expression, and you think, that's not for today.
Kathy Fitzgerald there at her eco-literacy workshop. Rachel Andrews was the reporter. And if you'd like more details on forthcoming eco-literacy workshops, howamay.site is the web address, because that's what earls are like now. Next, an almost rhetorical question.
Is it already too late to say it's too early to start talking about Christmas? Nah. For his latest epistle from the front lines of mild misgivings, Owen Nolan has been thinking about what happens in Ireland once we get a sniff of the approaching, astoundingly elastic period of Winterval festivities. Thoughts he's now marshalled for the latest, slightly unreasonable point of view.
This is the time of year when the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness gives way suddenly to the season of low light, lingering fog, and the deep, rich scent of rotting vegetation. When afternoon seems to rudely push past morning and the sky is an ominous pearl. Windows of daytime are short and shuttered and covered in condensation, and it is, as the African taxi driver noted of the huge grey above us, like living under an elephant. Somewhere, somebody urgently announces, we're losing the light, a cry called out in one way or another for millennia. It's not for nothing that this time of the year evokes our ancestors, prone on the cold, damp stone, using rudimentary implements to work out the line of the sun's rays at the solstice for the chieftain's tomb. Probably all under the unforgiving stare of stern figures chalking things on slate, early event managers dealing with the IT department. Long after the beaker folk had reached their quota of beaker production, you break it, you pay for it, the Romans named Ireland Hibernia, or Winterland, the same root as gives us the word hibernation, though very few creatures hibernate on the island now, apart from bats and hedgehogs. Others, like the badger, enter a state called carnivorian lethargy, which sounds like a kind of extended duvet day involving pizza delivery. Our ancestors bunkered down as best they could and tried to make the saved provisions last. Yet they understood that every stretch of rationing needs a feast, and that coinciding that feast with a celebration of a deity is, cosmologically, a safe bet. This wisdom was passed along as the old gods gave way to the new, and so we have Christmas in bleak midwinter. the perfect time, in this chilly hemisphere at least, to break out the preserves, light the candles, bring the last surviving greenery indoors, get out the good beakers and slaughter some dinner. It's the holidays, as they like to call it in America, having insisted on calling every other annual holiday a vacation. For the world of work in Ireland, in a kind of mass delusion, Christmas is not officially any kind of big holiday at all. It's just a short winter interval, a break between the old year and the new that no one talks about much. How long are you closed for? People ask each other breezily and accept answers like, oh, we'll be in on the Monday, acting as if we believe them. Yet we who have worked through 20 or more Irish Christmases, we know that nobody will be in on the Monday in any real sense until January the 13th next year. The reality is that in an unspoken act of self-inflicted, orchestrated industrial sabotage, all Indigenous enterprise comes to a halt for the Christmas season, which is a fifth season concealed within the other four seasons. Christmas, advertised immediately after Halloween, is a signal to people to slow down and focus on stoppage. Sand is in the gears not long after November arrives. Carnivorian lethargy has taken hold, and just as well, because all the restaurants are booked out. By mid-December, the whole thing is either ground to a halt or spins recklessly on one wheel. An insane bidding war of implausible excuses where late mornings, client entertainments, departmental parties and school plays vie with annual gatherings of people who barely know each other. Would you look who it is? All rolled together into one endless, unstoppable snowball. It's not blue collar or white collar anymore, as the colourless people of Ireland, their numbers swelled by a returning army of thirsty revellers with fresh legs who want to meet everyone down the pub and catch the last train, are feverish in their desire to make this year's celebration of Christmas in Ireland the biggest of them all. To paraphrase Woody Allen, not only is it the birthday of the baby Jesus, but try getting a plumber after mid-November. Oh, shit. That's the plumber. Do you mind if I take... Sorry. You turn off that. Yeah, hi, how are you? Did you have a look at the diary?
Owen Nolan there with a slightly unreasonable point of view, of which he has many. A selection of them can be found via the Lyric site and on the Culture Files SoundCloud page, where you'll find a Supov playlist.
Yeah, essentially a Bloody Mary, but yeah. with beetroot juice.
And finally, this time, we browse the shelves of the Libraries of Ethers as we meet whisky writer, Scotch evangelist and Glaswegian Dave Broome. Broome is behind a new documentary exploring the flows of Scottish whisky through poetry, prose and song in Scotland. He was in Dublin this week for the launch of The Amber Light, where a rarely heard tag team of Culture Files Luke Clancy, sounds familiar, and Sunday Business Post wine and spirits correspondent Tomás Clancy shared a wee dram with Dave Broome.
My name is Dave Broome. I'm a whisky writer and I'm in Dublin for the premiere of my film, The Amber Light.
How can I ever know you? How can I ever know you?
I came into spirits really, I think, as any kind of whisky geek. I comes into spirits thinking that if I understood the process, I understood all the facts and figures and the data, I'd be able to crack the code. And then it was only after a few years and really beginning to talk to blenders and whisky makers and listening to the way that they talked about it as being artistic as well as scientific, but really the impulse was an artistic impulse that made me kind of look at it in a different way. And I think as soon as you see it as having an artistic value to it and an artistic impulse to it, then you see that it is then part of a kind of culture as well. And it does influence the culture. So the whole point about the film is, you know, the way that whisky has interacted with Scottish literature and Scottish music over the centuries.
How will I ever tame you until I know it makes you wild? Where is the fire water tonight? Where is the fire water?
Incredible musicians working obliquely within the folk music tradition, like Alistair Roberts. Alistair just came out completely unprompted, just saying that, you know, You know, I was thinking about the creative process of writing a song and kind of the alchemical way, you know, that things come together in terms of writing a song. And it's exactly the same as making whiskey. You know, at that point, I kind of leapt off the chair and hugged him, you know. And it was really fascinating to see all these people working in what is a different creative sphere coming up with exactly the same words and same metaphors as whiskey makers we were talking to, when they were talking about how they approach making whiskey.
From that taste we make our mortar, quicken with the fire water.
Where is the fire water?
Then of course we hear the granite.
From the outset, what we wanted was this not to be a film about how whiskey is made. Because as soon as you go down that route, and great films have been made about it, as soon as you go down that route, you have to film about 20 different distilleries to explain what the subtle differences are between them. We wanted to look at it and get it from artists and musicians and writers as well, to get their take on it, their take on the kind of the creative process and their take on what whiskey means to Scotland. So a writer like, I mean, the amazing Alistair Gray, you know, what he says about whiskey, you know, is his line is that he likes drinking it because it stupefies him. Because, you know, a man of a very active intellect needs something to be able to go to sleep, otherwise his brain won't stop working. But at the same time, he's got very perceptive things to talk about, that kind of terroir thing about how Scotland is this bunch of very small countries kind of jammed together, each with their own personality and language and accent, etc.
Do you think there's a voice in Scotch that is different from whiskey in Ireland, say, I suppose you're over here, or whiskies in the United States or across the world? Is there a very clear Scottish voice ringing through?
I did a book about Japanese whiskey recently, and somewhat glibly said the Japanese make the best Japanese whiskey in the world, and then actually began to think about what I just said. And it's true, you know, because Japanese culture and history impact on the whiskey that they make and the flavours that they're generated. And I think the same happens in America. I think the same happens in Ireland. And the reasons for it might be political, it might be economic, or it might be driven by environment. But I think each whiskey-making country has its own individual identity, which comes around flavour.
Take the shortest month, fix my magnetic knot, my bipolar crust.
The smell in here is absolutely amazing. Just open that door and this wonderful, sweet
waft. Damp earth and the magic that is a warehouse.
You're never tired of this, do you?
No.
When you're out in the field, I mean, do you kind of, are you surrounded by different smells? Are you consciously smelling things? And
yeah, you know, like the harvest time, straw has a wonderful smell, and you sometimes pick that up in a whiskey.
For me.
If you look at the whiskies from the islands, you know, the reason that those whiskies are smoky is because there were no trees and there wasn't any coal and there was no oil rigs, you know, 200 years ago. You know, so if they were drying their barley, they had to dry it over peat. Therefore, their whiskies were smoky. So I think there's a direct link to environment there. I think when you're looking at whiskies from the Speyside, for example, that's kind of been more economically driven. You know, they could get coal up there, so the style began to change. But in a kind of wider context, what for me is really interesting is if you look at the big blends, you know, if you look at the Johnnie Walker signature, Johnnie Walker was a West Coast whiskey. You know, it was made in Kilmarnock. The whiskies that the Walker family used were local whiskies. So they were coming in from the islands, they were coming in from Campbellton, and they were bigger and they were heavier. And the Glasgow palate and the West Coast palate was famously bigger and heavier. Everybody preferred richer styles. If you look at Shivett's Brothers up in Aberdeen, they weren't using smoky whiskies because they were getting all their stock from Speyside, which by then was making a lighter style. So I think at that point, you begin to see blenders and the blends and the blend recipes reflecting their local palate. And the same thing happened with tea. You know, it probably came from tea. So there was an Edinburgh palate, there was a Glasgow palate, there was an Aberdeen palate, and you begin to see styles emerging through that. And that is, for me, another element of terroir. You know, it's not driven by the soil, but it's driven by a mentality in the palate. I think the intriguing thing about Scotch is that because it's had this dominant position in world whisky for about 100 years, that in the last wee while, I think Scotch has kind of forgotten what its roots were. And what has been fascinating for me, looking at how whisky's evolved in the last maybe decade or so, is that the distillers with real foresight are beginning to go back to their roots and actually beginning to say, right, how does it speak to me? You know, how does it manifest where I'm from and who I am and where it's from? So I think what you're seeing in Scotch is it's beginning to kind of emerge from just being a globalised spirit into something which has a sense of place again.
All the people we've mentioned so far are men. Are there no women in the Scottish whisky industry?
There are lots of women in the Scotch whisky industry. Sarah Burgess, who is in the film, she's the whisky maker at Macallan. In fact, Macallan have now got an all-women whisky team. There are so many master distillers now all across Scotland who are women as well. So, and part of the story is that how distillation was originally a secret known by women. You know, it was wise women. You know, because it was medicinal initially. So the role of women within distillation was incredibly important, and I think that has now come full circle. So women's role within whisky now is as important now as it was all these years ago.
Dave Broom there in his film The Amber Light can be seen in all good cinemas nationwide from November 22nd. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back next Friday at 7 with more storied distillates. And the Culture File Daily starts again on Monday in Classic Drive at 6:10 p.m. Till then, bye now.